Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Andy McGrath. Andy is the author of Beast of Britain. Andy is a crypto enthusiast with over 25 years of research and obsession about the unknown creatures living right under our noses here on this tiny island in the North Atlantic. Of course, Andy is referring to Great Britain and the United Kingdom in general. From a wildlife point of view, the accepted fauna of the British Isles were discovered and cataloged in their finite and immovable state in the 19th century. Nothing has really been added to this list or considered worthy since, and the continual reports of water monsters, Bigfoot, mystery big cats, and unidentified flying cryptids are largely ignored or used as newspaper fillers to entertain us. Andy's focus is on current research and recent sightings, pictures, videos, and eyewitness accounts of the many cryptids of the British Isles. Although vast advancements in science and technology have brought great discoveries in other lesser-known parts of the world, our island, the United Kingdom, lies largely underexplored and overlooked. At night, outside of the busy cities and next to the unlit lakes and lonely mountains, it is an island in darkness, where nobody ventures into the woods anymore, and the pervading paradigm scares all but the most foolhardy scientists away from any serious investigation of the many yet to be discovered beasts of Britain. So without any further ado, Andy McGrath, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Hi, James. Very nice to be here.
Thank you, Andy. And thanks to our mutual friend, Christopher Turner, for, you know, making it possible for us to have this interview. For the benefit of our listeners, Andy, tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into this very important work of cryptozoology.
Well, I've always been a fan of things like the Loch Ness Monster and Bigfoot and the Citroen. I suppose being somebody in his early 40s and, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, things like the Paddy footage was very current then, and great programs like In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy and the Arthur C. Clarke Mysterious World as well, which was very influential on me. I started thinking from a very early age, what if these creatures actually exist? What are people seeing? And that was a very peripheral interest. Now, when I was about 15 or 16 years old, I started becoming interested in these stories of alien big cats in the UK, panthers and cougars and pumas and things like that. And as I became older, I started dating a girl that lived in the west of Wales, near the Preseli Mountains. And her sister told me a story, and a very skeptical girl as well. She told me a story about riding over the Preseli Mountain, away from a friend's farm she'd been visiting. And it's very rural there, so it's not very common, you know, that you have somebody very close to you. So she was riding a mile or two home from the next farm over a mountain. It's a steep hill, so to speak. And she looked back, and in the farmyard there, in the sheep pen, she saw a large black cat chasing sheep. And she was shocked to see this. Now, you know, I asked her, when you say large, how big is it large? She said, about the size of a Labrador, an Arthur sheep, very long tail, and small rounded ears, like a black panther, essentially. It was very interesting. I knew her to be a very grounded person, and not somebody who was taken to flights of fancy. Very same year, we were staying in this farmhouse near the Preseli Mountains over the Christmas period, and I was there with my partner and her sister and her parents, and some people had come up from London. And one of them, a woman, she was a heavy smoker, so she had apparently gone out at about 5 a.m. in the morning to have a cigarette on the porch area there, on the patio. And sat down, lit up a cigarette, and in the light she saw a panther standing about 10, 12 feet away from her, just staring at her. Now, you know, this poor lady from London, middle-aged lady, had never seen anything like that. Clearly was expecting to see, and it wasn't commonly known, a large black predatory cat staring back at her, and she was quite shocked. And we went searching for it the next day, and I was hooked. Basically, I was hooked on this possibility. And every year I would look at the British Big Cat Society and other things like the Centre for Fortean Zoology has a big cat page. It's very useful. And see that there's tens and 20s and 30s and hundreds of sightings and thousands of sightings now in the last 40 years, I think it is, almost, since this Dangerous Wild Animals Act was introduced in the UK, restricting and monitoring the use the keeping of exotic pets, especially dangerous exotic pets like cats and crocodiles and things like that. And these days, it's a monthly occurrence. A paper here or a paper here reports, you know, panther seen here, lion sometimes seeing the leopard, cougar, puma. Normally, they tend to be in the either the black panther or the sort of tawny puma, cougar type category. They seem to fit into those two. And I would suggest that those two types of cats would be best adapted to our environment anyway. So that was it. That started me off. Later, as the internet started to come into force a little bit more, and YouTube and things started to come into play, I started looking into all these little cryptozoology websites and seeing pictures of the Loch Ness Monster, and you know, some convincing, some not so convincing, and looking into things like Loch Ness, which is obviously, you know, it's the big pariah, you know, this 84-year-old center of lake monster activity without any definitive proof. What really sat with me very well was the amount of corroboration in the sightings, the different types of professions and positions that people had come from who made the sightings. The amount of people that described, you know, a head on a long neck with humps or flippers or, you know, a long tail and things like that. And it started a process in which I started looking around the world, but also around our country to see, you know, was there any other area where there were these lake or sea monsters of similar description? And I found lots. I mean, many, many reports over the years, and even recently, you know, there's many in Wales, in the lakes and in the coast as well. I started to come to this, come upon this theory, basically, where I started to realize these creatures are transient. They don't always live in these lakes. They come in and out of the lakes and lochs and to the sea. And in most cases, although it's not always a direct route, in most cases there was a direct or at least a water-based route to the sea. And I started thinking, well, then how would they not be seen? They wouldn't be seen because Britain, after dark, it's a dark country. If you're not in the city and you're in the rural landscape, and when it's dark, and when I visited Loch Ness in 2012 with my wife for our honeymoon, belated honeymoon, it's an understanding crypto wife. So when I visited Loch Ness, and I went down and stood next to the loch at night, and I was near Drumna Drochin, which is a popular area. There's a few visitor centres there. I suddenly realised that I couldn't see anything. I was right on the edge of a deep body of water where I believed there was a large predatory creature, and I don't know exactly what it is. There's no reports of it eating people, but still, you know, none that we know of. I suddenly became very afraid. I thought, oh my gosh, I can't see anything here. It's wooded. There's hills everywhere. How would you know if one of these creatures was walking around on land, you know, after dark? And there have been land sightings. They're rare, but they happen. And it just intrigued me. And I started looking for other things. The British Bigfoot, the British Dogman, the little people, or the hairy fairy folk, as we call them here, which are very similar to the Australian Janjari or the Hawaiian Manahuna. And I just thought, this is amazing. How is it in this well-explored island, you know, that produced some of the most influential scientists the world has ever seen? And, you know, we're basing most of our science and our natural sciences on what they discovered, still on the principles they discovered. And yet here in their own land, there's still creatures swimming and creeping about that we don't know anything about. And it amazed me. And that was it. That was the start of it. Now, as far as the book went, I became really fed up watching these TV shows in the US and other places of our country being overlooked. And the Finding Bigfoot team came here looking for the British Bigfoot and kind of, in a way, brushed it aside and said, there isn't the habitat. That made me mad. I said, okay, I'm going to look at this. I'm going to contact people to study this subject. And I I got in touch with the British Bigfoot Research Group, probably the best group of that kind here, and a lady called Deborah Hatswell, and Christopher Turner, who you know, who's making an awesome documentary called Elusive about that particular subject, and found that there were, you know, up to 400 sightings of these types of creatures going all the way back to, you know, ancient times. But these 400 sightings were recent sightings. She herself, I think, had a sighting in 1983 in a place called Salford near Manchester, when she was, we call it mitching or bunking off school. I don't know if you call it the same thing, cutting class. She was cutting class with a friend, and she was in the woods there, and in a little sort of estate that had a very wooded area in it, and suddenly saw this 7 foot tall, for want of a better explanation, wild man or Bigfoot staring at her out of the bushes. And it affected her for years and years. And even now, you know, she's become dedicated to this subject, to find other witnesses and actually give them somebody to talk to about it. So, yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting subject. There is a lot here, and there's also a lot of adversity to this subject in the UK from homegrown researchers in this field, who just say, well, no, it's not possible. And to that I always answer, well, what are the witnesses seeing? You know, in the subject that you cover yourself, you know, you're well aware of people saying things aren't possible, but there's never an explanation for what people are describing they're seeing. It just can't happen. You can't see that. That's what people say, right? Yeah. You can't possibly see that, because we know that that doesn't exist. But if you ask them how they know, they're not usually able to tell you, are they? Just that we don't believe it, and that's that. So, yes, that was my start into this field, and I'm loving it. You know, it's going really well, and people are showing a true interest in the subject.
I was particularly fascinated in hearing about the Bigfoot Sasquatch research going on over there. And for the benefit of our listeners and watchers, what are some of the names that people give these large, hairy hominoids over there? I mean, the Native Americans, for example, practically every tribe has their own name for Sasquatch. Oh. What do they call this animal over there?
Well, the old English name for them is Woodwose. Mm. The Woodwose. So some people spell that wood, then W-O-O-S-E. I spell it in the old way, W-O-D-E, W-O-S-E. The Woodwose, and they're an old wild man or forest people. There are many depictions of them on our churches and in our ancient sculptures and drawings. And they're hairy type forest man, often carrying a club or a sort of some weapon of some kind, that's said to live in the forest and take care of it. There's another one which is known as the Green Man, you know, which comes into a lot of pagan folklore, this benevolent keeper of the forest. What's interesting about that is some of these British Bigfoot sightings are made by people that have seen a creature, ape man-like creature, in the woods covered in foliage. So it would almost seem like they're part of the foliage themselves, which is an interesting side to it as well. Perhaps that helps to originate, to give an origination for that particular name. People these days call them the UK Wildman or Bigfoot. That's the most popular name. That's the best way to get it across. The chapter in my book that actually covers the UK Wildman or Bigfoot is called Tales of the Woodwose. So it's about that history and recognizing that history that we have here and in Europe, and giving people, you know, a historical background to these creatures instead of letting their minds meander into the, well, you know, Bigfoot is a big subject right now in the US and everywhere. Everybody wants to see a Bigfoot. You British guys, you just want to have a Bigfoot. This is why you started this thing. Instead of saying, well, yes, you do have a history of creatures like these in antiquity. And perhaps now people are only just starting to feel brave enough to talk about it.
Yeah, it seems to be another manifestation of like, American exceptionalism, you know. It's like, well, we have the Bigfoot and Sasquatch, but you Pommies are like newbies in all this. When, ironically, you know, there has been civilizations there on the British Isles since time immemorial. Now,
well,
to any of the stories from ancient times, Celtic times, pre-Roman times, have they survived of these beings?
There are stories. I don't have any to hand, unfortunately. That's also something I prep for. I generally concentrate on modern sightings. The reason for that, and it's the same with my lake monsters and sea monsters and pterosaurs and whatnot, the reason for it is that ancient sightings always fall into myth.
Yes.
Anything from the past, where people were more simple, in our minds at least.
Stupid and superstitious.
Yeah, superstitious. And they were more superstitious, no more than we are in some areas of the country and parts of the world now. But I'll come on to that a bit later. But they were superstitious, and yet still, superstition myth was a way of describing something you were unfamiliar with. So our trolls, for instance, often have a very similar appearance to the Woodwows, to the British Bigfoot. And I think that's, you know, it's very interesting. We always discount history. I asked somebody recently on a website about the dragon dinosaur crossover, especially the flying dragons and pterosaur crossover. And I grew up in Wales, so of course we have the Welsh dragon on the flag.
Yes.
And even though it's a four-legged dragon with bat wings, it does have this very peculiar diamond-shaped tail, sail tail, they call it, which is it's cartilage. It's not something you can observe most times on the fossil. So you can't use an old fossil discovery to describe its depiction. And it appears on lots of dragon tails. And you think, well, okay, this is a very significant fact, you know, of ancient description that we can't account for in people finding old big bones in the ground. It doesn't tie in. And I think we need to think better of the people that came before us instead of thinking that they were stupid. We still can't describe or we still can't explain half of the monuments that they made. And we can't build them in some cases here. And yet we seem to think that they were very simple.
Yes, this knee-jerk dismissive notion that they're just dumb, super superstitious.
They were dumb, yeah.
Now, as far as the modern sightings are concerned, the people that tend to have encounters with the Sasquatch, for lack of a better term, in America, tend to be, you know, outdoorsy type people or park rangers when they, you know, choose to speak anonymously and whatnot. Could you give us an example of what some of the really fascinating modern sightings of the British Bigfoot have been?
I'll give you a few. And with the British Bigfoot, obviously our environment is different. Yes, we have lots of hills and wood and lots of rural areas, and we only have got 16% urban sprawl of the entire country of 60 plus million people. So there's a lot of empty land out there, but it's not as wooded as some of these places in North America and Russia. And yeah, it's a different environment. So most of the sightings are made near roads or on country walks and things like that, near habitations. One I'll give you, which is very interesting, I think, because of the ape-like characteristics that it displays. It is on a golf course, and it's called the Salford Wild Man, another sighting in that area of Salford we discussed earlier. And it was in July 2016, and there was a gentleman who was golfing with his friends at Ellesmere Golf Course in Worsley. And when he noticed a 7-foot-tall, hairy, and human-shaped ape man with a barrel-shaped chest, it was kind of hunched over. He described it as looking old or injured in some way. Now, I think that's a very interesting description because it shows that he really got a good look at it to determine some sort of age or conditioning of the animal. And he said it was swaying from side to side as if it was agitated and clapping its hands loudly and moving them like it was making some sort of sign language. And the men, they watched it for a short period of time, amazed. It was just in the tree line, amazed by what they were seeing. And suddenly they heard a loud wail off to the side of the creature, and it turned it and ran away. Now, that sighting to me, that's really, really extraordinary. Okay, you could say perhaps there was some escaped orangutan or something like that around. maybe, it's very unlikely, you know, I think all of the orangutans in the country would be accounted for. But if there was something like that, it had to be 7 feet tall. It had to be old. It had to convince these men that they were looking at a man and an ape at the same time. And that's, it's a very matter-of-fact sighting. You know, it lacks flair, doesn't it? You know, and that's what I like about a lot of the sightings. They lack the flair of an imaginary situation. You know, very general characteristics. That's a very good one. There's another one I wanted to tell you about in Bristol, which is in the southwest of England, or west of England. And now, this was in 2013, in August, and a resident of the area is walking through Leigh Woods Nature Reserve when he heard some noises, and he saw a large ape-like creature digging in the earth with a twig. Had it back to him, was digging in the earth with a twig, and it picked something up and began eating it. He said, then used the twig to pick its teeth, stood up, snapped a large tree branch, and leaned it against another tree, and also wove some twigs together. And then he said this creature was about 6 feet tall. It was very old looking with grey skin, and it had almost small breasts. Now, what's interesting about this, an old man, obviously sometimes we get small pockets around the chest, don't we? Man breasts, they call them, don't they? So we get these small pockets around the chest. And again, here's this description of an ape man-like creature, very large, again, doing something an ape would do, something with a tool. He's using a tool to dig up maybe some worms or grubs or something of some kind, some sort of food, maybe a root. And then he's performing a very Bigfoot-like characteristic. He's breaking a branch, and he's leaning up against another tree. He's also weaving some sticks together. Now, what we find here in this country a lot, something called glyphs, which are these different shapes that a lot of researchers attribute to these British Bigfoot creatures. And they can be found in North America and other places as well. And the sticklings, these weird sticks leaning against trees in certain directions, or little teepees, and they don't know why they do them. Some people think they put it there to show other creatures whether there's a food source or which way they've gone. And it's almost a forest sign, you know, this way to the location, you know, the little arrow. So those two sightings, I think, are very, very interesting. You know, they share a lot of characteristics with other Bigfoot creatures around the world as well.
And that first one you described near the golf course, it was quite nuanced. Like, for example, if someone was going to make up a Bigfoot sighting, they wouldn't include the detail of the being clapping its hands.
No.
They wouldn't include a detail of it looking, or the perception that the witness had that it was kind of aged and maybe infirm. I mean, those are nuanced details that an eyewitness would likely come up with.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for me, I had... as soon as I read that one, I had senile old man ape in my head. You lost your marble a little bit. You've strayed out of the house, out of the care center, and Nursie is calling you back and saying, come away from the men. I do think that they are apes of some kind. You know, of course, Gigantopithecus is allegedly just 100,000 years ago, and they've never found really that, you know, the hips and the leg bones of this creature, or at least nothing suitable to show whether it walked on all fours or whether it was a bipedal. And I think, you know, all around the world, in almost every region, there is some sort of bipedal ape legend. Every one of them describes something intelligent, quite elusive, that stays away from man most of the time, but it's also curious. And most of these instances, where people see them, there are things like road crossings, or they're where the ape has come a little closer to people to have a look and see what's going on. And there was a joke about these little shapes and these glyphs and things that they make in the forest sometimes, or these little sticklings that don't seem to be a habitation. They're just in odd shapes. And somebody joked that, you know what, the forest is boring. Sometimes you whittle, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe they just, oh, cause so now I'm messing around with some, like other apes do, playing around with objects around them and you know, utilizing their environment as a place of interest. So, yeah.
I've looked at some of those, at least in North America, and they seem to be like large branches that have been arranged in the form of what we would call a teepee, for lack of a better term.
Yes.
And it struck me usually is that might be too small for a Sasquatch. Yeah. So yes. It's not a domicile. What is it, you know?
Yeah, and it does seem that way. I mean, we could consider the possibility that some of them are used to shelter smaller.
Yeah, for smaller ones. For young, perhaps, yeah.
Which we would have here. The issue we have here a lot is there's a lot of bushcraft that erects these types of stick teepees as well in our forest. So I went to investigate something in Ashridge State Park Forest. Somebody had seen a lot of sticklings and little rudimentary teepees there and photographed them nearby. I went up into the main forest, but growls had been heard and an acorn had been thrown at somebody through the forest. It was beautiful. It was a really old forest. You know, it was very deep and thick. But what I found all around was bushcraft. Some of it very good. And eventually when we came to the end, we found the masterclass versions of these teepees with pull ties around them, and they were all set up. Probably it suddenly became very clear, okay, there's a bushcraft in school here. The issue is with identifying the teepees, especially, or some of the sticklings, as UK Bigfoot or bushcrafters. If you're a learner, you're a child, and you're learning this art out in the forest, you might do something very simple and leave it there. Why would you take it away? And you know, then you look for other signs around to see if there's other indications of the habitation. Is there a glyph, like the A glyph that's left, or pinwheel? Is there a high branch break, perhaps, somewhere? A branch snap, something that would be too difficult for a human to break and hasn't been broken, you know, with other falling trees. So lots of signs you can look for, but I would say it's actually a very difficult business to determine what you're looking at.
Now, two of the places that you mentioned, if memory serves, Bristol and Manchester, I, you know, spent time, you know, passing through both places. Bristol in 87 and then Bolton, but you know, of course, it's a suburb of Manchester, and those strike me as somewhat built up places. So I'm guessing that these sightings had occurred on the outskirts of Bristol and Manchester.
Yes, in Bristol, it was in Lee Woods, and there's a lot of just outside of Bristol city town, there's lots of countryside, and the same in Manchester, it's all really surrounded by countryside. Now, what the British Bigfoot Research Group talk about a lot is green corridors. All these motorway sidings and paths. And as you even drive or on motorways or take trains to the country, what you'll notice is oodles and oodles of open and empty countryside stretching either side of the roads and the train tracks on and on and on. And between every town and city, there's just countryside. So we mentioned that we've only got 16% urban sprawl in the entire country. That means that, you know, a large body of the 60 plus million people live in cities.
Yes.
One of the things that recently I was taking the train to Wales, and I just thought, let's just look out the window. Let's look for farmhouses. And from London, between London and Wales, there's only 2.5 hours in the train. So for farmhouses, habitations, and then it's daytime, and it's a clear day. Let's look for people walking around. And also things like streetlights and other things that would illuminate the areas at night. And I was very disappointed to not see anybody in the middle of the day, even, you know, walking around anywhere in these areas where there were even habitations. And between, there was just vast areas of land. And Britain's a small country, but not if you're walking.
Yes. And it's that's easy to get the impression that it's not really big. But I mean, just the Britain part of it is as big, if not bigger, than California. And I remember when I hitchhiked from London to Wales, I went down to the Gower Peninsula, and you're right. It's like there's not really a lot in between. And that was 87. I imagine, you know, it'd be a little bit more built up now. But back then, I was struck by just how much open space. And then I went to the Lakes District too, and you're right, it's like it's pitch dark out there. I mean, I was right there by Lake Windermere, and like it's dark. I mean, dark.
And black. Like, and of course, we've got we're a country where 70% of the year they estimate is overcast weather.
Yes.
It means it's usually gray and cloudy and at night as well. It's raining and it's a dark place. One of the lines in the intro that you read, there's a chapter about it. It's called A Nocturnal Isolation, An Island in Darkness. Now, it's easy to say, oh, well, they come out at night. These things come out at night. They move at night. The Bigfoot, the lake monsters, the pterosaurs, whatever, the big cats. But it probably is the best explanation for creatures that are often sighted but can't be found. Either they have intelligence or they have environments that are not conducive to being generally sighted and reported and found. You mentioned Lake Windermere. Of course, you've got Beau Nessie, the monster of Lake Windermere, which is, you know, a very Nessie-like creature.
I wasn't aware there was a Nessie-like creature there. Did you want to elaborate on that?
Yes, I will. So that's been spotted. Really, the sightings really took off in 2004. There's several photos of this creature, actually. And it's, you know, it's the same Nessie-type creature. It's a humped creature. It's got a long neck, a serpentine or horse-like head, flippers, you know, a long tail. So it's a classic lake monster, really. I can give you one of the last sightings, was amazing. Actually, now, see if I can get a picture up here. And that was made by one of the journalists from the Autographer magazine. Now, what she did, she was testing out a time-lapse camera that took a picture every 1 minute for wildlife, for the changing of the seasons. And she placed it along the lake in 2014, and she went away, essentially. Now, what happened with this is when she got the camera back, she took it and started flicking through the images, she saw in the distance a humped, long-necked creature of a Nessie-type variety. Now, it was really slated in the papers, oh, they're just trying to sell their new camera that they're advertising here. But there was never any hint of a fake or a hoax. And you know, the people themselves never admitted to it being a hoax. And I don't really feel that it did a lot for their camera, other than, you know, this woman had a great sighting. So let me just look at the first sighting here. I'm just bringing them up. So, okay.
Okay. Now, size, is the Lake Windermere animal, is that comparable to what they've seen at Loch Ness?
It is, yeah. It is. It's a sort of between 20 and 40 feet. So it would show that different individuals have been seen. Which is very interesting, again, just to think that there's more than one of these creatures. I mean, to me, that makes perfect sense that there's more than one. But of course, we're living in a world where we like to think of, you know, relict, super, super ageless animal like Nessie living on by herself forever and ever and ever. And the same with this. What's very interesting about this particular creature is there is something called the River Leven, which is quite a short river, actually, that leads out to the sea. From Windermere, and many of the lakes at Windermere and Bassethwaite Lake, they connect, you know, and there's routes out to the sea. So it shows that there's a nice route in, you know, perhaps this creature comes in following eel migrations or salmon or whatever, and there's great fishing in, great trout and salmon fishing as well in Windermere and the rivers that connect to it. I think that they come in and out, they follow these food sources. And that's why we don't see them all the time. And I do agree with the theory that if they were resident in these lakes, that they would be seen frequently. And yet, you know, a creature like this that's only seen on occasion, really lends itself to a transient identity. I don't know if it's can be regulated. I have really looked into, you know, whether we can predict based upon food sources where they will appear, you know, based on where they've appeared in previous years. And with a place like Loch Ness, I've discovered that their sightings are directly linked to rainfall. In that, the more rainfall there is, the less salmon there are, because salmon are insectivorous, and there's less insects when there's more rainfall, therefore there's less salmon. So I did about 16 years study and realized that whenever the rainfall was high, the salmon catch was low, there were less sightings. And reverse, when the salmon catch was high, there were more sightings. So it shows that the creature comes in and out at certain points, sees that there's a big food source, sticks around, or sees that there isn't really a big food source and leaves. And perhaps hunts elsewhere, you know, around the British Isles or in other lakes. There are 31,400 lochs and lochans in Scotland alone. So, I mean, that's a huge amount of different bodies of water, many of which are directly connected to the sea. Just briefly, I'm going on, but talking about Bonessie. So the first established site was in 2006 by a lecturer, Steve Burnup, and he saw three humps, 20 feet long, moving through the water. And there was no boat inside, no boat weight, nothing like that. Then we had Lyndon Adams, took a picture of the creature, and said it was about 15 feet in length. That was in 2007. There were a few other sightings, and later there was a very significant photo by Tom Pickles, and he took a photo of a humped object in 2011 while kayaking on an outdoor adventure company day out. And he was with a lady called Sarah Hunt.
Momentarily lost Andy.
Yeah. So one of the very significant aspects of this creature and was the long neck, and also the Tom Pickles, who photographed the creature in 2011, he actually saw many small humps in the water, which I've always taken to be the neck of the creature bunched up. Now, it sounds strange, but I think that in the spine next to these creatures, I think they have a lot of flexibility. So sometimes we see one oval hump, sometimes we see one or two, and they have been observed moving. So the creature that was photographed at Lake Windermere in 2014, and that was by the L, who worked for Autographer magazine, it has a sharp hump and a long swan-like neck. The creature that was photographed in 2011, it's just several bumps in the water. And it just looks like a black formation of bumps in a way that you see in lots of lake monster and sea monster photos all over the world, this bumpy description. I do believe there's a lot of flexibility in the animal's physiological makeup, in the spine. There have been stories about people seeing this hump change shape. So in the case of Morgaur, which is the Cornish sea serpent, spotted in Falmouth Bay and other areas on the Cornish coast, which is on the southwest peninsula of England, a beautiful area, very, very filled with different types of cryptids. The person who saw it and photographed it actually shows two photos, has two humps, and they're in different positions. They described its humps moving in a muscular kind of way.
Undulating almost.
Yeah, so that's very strange, isn't it? There's another situation where there was a very interesting creature seen in Salton Cove in Paignton. I believe that was also in 2011 or 2012. I have that here somewhere. 2011 or 2012, anyway. And this creature was seen hunting a shoal of mackerel in the shallows. It's said to be about 12 to 15 feet long. And so it's has a round body like a turtle, a long neck and a head and four flippers, and is chasing these creatures around. And one of the witnesses sees it come up onto a seaweed bank on top of it, outside of the water, and arch its back up into a point as if it's ready to go back in. Now, this very peculiar aspect to that story, another aspect in which the witness actually sees it change its color from a sort of a seaweedy greeny brown to a black, and it goes into the shade onto the seaweed and turns a black kind of color. Then as it heads back out into the water, he watches the hump change color. Now, when this was first reported, nobody picked up on that at all. This chameleonic ability, perhaps, to change color, or whatever it was, however it mimicked its environment or changed color to hide and stalk these fish. This is a previously undescribed aspect of these creatures. And it came home to me that perhaps they do have some sort of camouflage, like other sea creatures do. Perhaps they're able to blend in against certain environments. Now, him describing a sort of a greeny brown color turning into a black reminded me of lots of other descriptions of well-known lake monsters where somebody says it was a gray, black, bluey color. It was a brown, greenish color. It was greenish gray. It was all black. And yet lots of these color descriptions are within the same bodies of water and describing the same identified beast, you know, Ogopogo, Champ, the Loch Ness Monster, things like that. So perhaps they can change color, you know, in a mild kind of way. When I say mild, I don't mean like pinks and greens and yellows like the chameleon, but in a very minor, monotone way, you know, like a boring library of beiges and browns and greens. A useful way, of course, to fit into your environment if the purpose is camouflage and not display. That was very interesting to me that people have seen these different types of colors. So there's lots of corroboration in descriptions. You have the humps turning into ridges, you know, turning into a one big boat-like hump, upturned boat hump. And I think it's a very long creature that's very stretched out and serpentine and sinuous. And I think in many cases, it's the same creature that has a lot of flexibility that we're currently unaware of, as we are of the creatures themselves. And that perhaps in the future, if we manage to discover them and catalogue the species, we'll start to understand this characteristic and exactly what its purpose is. Personally, I think it's like a wind-up. I think the two brothers that saw the San Francisco sea serpent, which was a very long, sinuous sea serpent that was, forget their names now, these two brothers, and they saw it chasing seals in San Francisco Bay. And I think they're very famous for their sightings. They've got some video evidence and things like that. They actually said underwater, they saw the creature curl up, bunch up, and then shoot off to the seals. And, you know, sometimes they have been, although they're supposedly undulate, many sea serpents and lake monsters, there have been stories of this corkscrew kind of aspect.
Like they're coiling the way like a snake would on the, like a snake. On the land.
So either like that, or maybe even sometimes the tail coiling in and then adding some sort of propulsion. All speculation, but there are some corroborative elements that seem to point in that direction.
Well, the points you made earlier about how Nessie and or the Windermere animal and others like them may hunt seasonally. This is something we've observed with other animals. This is what the orca do along the California coast. This is what the grizzly do in the salmon run. So it would make sense if a creature that large would have to ingest a lot of food to sustain itself. It's going to go where the prey is.
And something that would back that up is that there are lots of sea Nessie sightings in the sea lochs and in the coasts around Scotland as well, and the rest of the UK. So there have been sightings in Loch Linnea, There was one in Carreran recently. That's a very recent sighting from this year, a big humped creature coming out of the water. There's sightings all around the Scottish coast and also the Welsh coast and around here too. So I would actually say in the UK, apart from if you take Loch Ness out of the equation, that has the largest amount of sightings anywhere, 11,000 plus allegedly. But let's face it, there's been millions of people looking at the lake Loch for 84 years. It's bound to have more sightings than other places with less attention. Most of our sea serpent or lake monster sightings are at sea.
Okay.
They're on coasts. They're in the surrounding coast and not in the lakes and lochs. You know, there's only really a handful of those that you can point to, the lakes and lochs, and say that here's a designated area where there are lots of sightings. There was a really, really interesting one in Wales, since you've been to Wales. That's one of my favorite places to talk about because it's my old backyard, so to speak. And as a former Celt, and I say former Celt because I don't drink anymore, so I was kicked out. There was this wonderful sighting along the coast there. So in 2016 in Aber Arran, which is about 60 miles south of Barmouth in Wales, there was a sighting in a waterway, a sea waterway there, of what appeared to be a sea monster with a shorter neck and a double serrated back. There's a photograph of it. The sighting was made by a pensioner in the early morning called Mohammed Takhla, and he was coming back to, on his way from getting his pension, and suddenly saw this large creature swimming about in the waterway, just through the center of the town, and took a few photos. The distance, they're blurry, but you can definitely make out a head and this weird double serrated, they call it cuirass. It's the back ridge that they have. It's very interesting. And I looked at other sightings there in Barmouth, where there was a crocodilian type creature seen on the beach. Walking along the muddy waterway, there was big round hippo-like footprints with claws in them. A group of schoolgirls in Hull saw a humped monster with a long neck and a long tail and bright green eyes at dusk, heading off the beach into the water, and it stayed there looking at them for a while. So there's been many, many sightings there over the years, and they seem to go from the top of the Mersey there, right to Liverpool, which is right above North Wales. There was a sighting in 2010 and a photo too of what seemed to be a black humped creature with a strange head down to the Barmouth estuary, and then down again to Aber Arran, and then further on into Llyn Tegid, or Lake Bala as it's called in North Wales, which is connected to the sea via the River Dee. So that's another inlet from that little pathway there. It's a 12-mile journey. I'm not saying it'd be easy, but there's been sporadic sightings in Lake Bala as well for a long time of a plesiosaur-like creature, a smaller one, 12 to 20 feet long, very, very physically descriptive. It's a football-sized head raised up out of the water on a 8 to 10-foot long neck. Two swimmers saw a large plesiosaur-like creature swimming beneath them as they were crossing the lake. And a girl was surprised on the shingle beach and turned around suddenly, feeling unnerved, and saw this creature, all black, out of the water looking at her. Suddenly, and many more in these areas. And just to me, we always look at these lake monster sightings in isolation. The mystery of Loch Ness. I think the only mystery of Loch Ness is that we're calling it a mystery still and treating it in isolation to all other reports around the world. It's odd, since it corroborates in detail to so many other reports, even in our own country. So we say, that's the mystery of Loch Ness. This is the mystery of Lake Bala. That's the mystery of the Mersey River monster. This is the mystery of the Barmouth estuary monster. And we compartmentalize them. And I think this is because of a philosophical paradigm that we exist in at the moment that says these creatures died out long ago. If they didn't, that sort of brings up weird questions about the paradigm that we're not ready to address yet.
Yes.
You know, maybe the way we've dated things isn't really as effective as we thought, which things like the coelacanth and horseshoe crab should have told us years ago, but still, we're still doing it. And I think in future, we'll find out, just like we did with the Komodo dragon or the okapi or the gorilla, that these anecdotal sightings, you know, were worth their salt after all, and were telling us about these unknown creatures that we were yet to discover at that point.
And it seems to me from what you've described that particularly when it comes to the lakes that have an outlet to the ocean, at least some of these animals seem to be able to hang around both saline seawater, if you will, and freshwater. Is that the case?
It does seem to be that way. And I think a reasonable explanation for that is that they're air breathers. And it doesn't mean that salt water and fresh water shouldn't have different effects on them. But if it's air that they breathe, it shouldn't really have a terrible effect.
Yeah.
Some of these waters leading in are brackish waters, but I think that they inhabit both fresh and salt water. And I think their amphibious nature and being air breathers, that's perhaps, you know, the way that they can do that. A lot of people do, even when they're, you know, they are in their seasons where they're spotted in Loch Ness and other places, a lot of people say, well, you know, they should be seen a lot more. But I think that assumes, you know, a few it places restrictions on an animal that we don't understand yet.
Yes.
So when we say the animal has to come up to breathe every hour, well, crocodiles can stay down for an hour. Maybe an animal that's 10 times its size can stay down for 3 hours. I always say, you know, what they'd have to move, especially in Loch Ness at some points, you know, they couldn't navigate the Caledonian Canal. They'd have to come out onto land and get back in at some points. Okay, so it's nighttime, they get out on land and they come back in. Well, they would leave a trail. Okay, so you're assuming that the person that sees the trail understands what he's seeing. You know, and this is also very wet part of the country. So that trail there could be destroyed quite easily, perhaps, you know, with a good overnight rain. But still, let's say that some animal comes and slithers across the grass, heavy animal, and then gets back into the water. And somebody says, oh, look at that indentation in the grass, or whatever that is, and gets on with their day.
Yes.
Because who's out looking for it? I mean, you know, your average guy who's going to work. And on the other side with the River Ness, you know, it's very shallow at points. I've walked the whole length of it. It's very, very shallow at some points. That's not to say, you know, cover of darkness, something couldn't amble through from time to time when the water's a bit higher. I think the only mystery of Loch Ness really is why there is still a mystery and why it plays host as an area to so many dedicated researchers who disbelieve in the existence of the animal and seem almost committed to debunking every sighting. Now, that's not to say sightings shouldn't be questioned. There was one I reported on recently which looked like a large fin. There's been similar sightings in the past, and it turned out that a boat took a picture of some fin-shaped wooden flotsam, you know, some driftwood, and that's fine. That's what we're supposed to do, investigate. But it does seem to be a philosophy of, you know, and anything but this plesiosaur kind of theory. You know, anything else will do. Well, I have large sterile eels, even though that's never been observed at 40 feet, 20 feet. They generally tend to grow outwards than lengthwards, these large eels. Or it's a sturgeon, although there's never been one caught in the lake. Or a giant catfish, although we know that catfish don't raise their necks out of water or slither over land with four flippers. You know, nothing ever matches it. There's even a theory that it's a giant mudskipper, previously an unknown species, with a plesiosaur-like neck and head-shaped lure on its head. And that, I mean, that's actually a theory from somebody I consider to be the best Loch Ness researcher there is. I won't mention the person's name, but he is by far the best researcher of this subject and cataloguing things and looking into all of the stories. And I think for somebody that intelligent to come up with that theory, it's because of the philosophical pressure of choosing something other than a plesiosaur. Because if you say in this field, I think these animals are plesiosaurs or, you know, mosasaurs or whatever the identity that each particular creature has is, then that's it. You're out of the running. You're not serious anymore. And yet, you know, if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a dinosaur, right? So you just have to say it. And I'm not the kind of person that is able to ignore a truth to save my, you know, to save my skin. And I don't have that much of a reputation to lose anyway at the moment, so it's fine. I can say it and say, well, yes, all of these sightings seem like plesiosaurs. Maybe they didn't die out.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem, well, some of them may have a vested interest, some of these arch debunkers, because maybe what they call a tenure in America, where a university professor has a tenure in a university, he has a vested interest in maintaining the status quo as far as zoology is concerned. So, so that could be an issue too. But I think by this point, the burden of proof is no longer on people like us, and especially yourself, who's made this kind of work a calling. You know, I mean, actually, it's not even on them either, because thanks to the internet, we no longer have this issue of the you know, the peer review journals and the circling of the wagons and you're an outsider, you don't have the letters after your name, and we
can just publish.
Yes, you know, and you know, one of the most compelling bits of evidence I've seen, you referenced earlier the classic show In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy, and I loved that show as a kid. And
I loved it. Yeah.
If memory serves, they did a segment on the Loch Ness creature, the monster, and there was film footage, archival film footage, of some British or Scottish guy who was trying to set some kind of speed record with a speedboat in the Loch Ness. And then, then he collided with something in the water. And he died, and then whatever he collided into started swimming away. It was like this big lump in the water, and then, do you remember that?
I don't remember the lump. I do remember the footage, the proposition that he hit something.
Oh, yes, and then, it may not have been a lump, but it could have been a wake of the whatever it was.
It was a counter wake.
Yeah.
And that kind of speed that would really, you know, make it an issue. There's been so many bits of evidence put forward. The reason in my book, Beasts of Britain, I concentrated mainly on anecdotal sightings, on witness testimony. So first I had all of these photos that I was going to include in them. This is this monster, that monster, and the other one. And for two reasons I stopped doing that. One, the cost of printing them was prohibitive. You know, just the copyright, to pay the copyright to each person. And I'm only a small person at this point. But secondly, people debunk photos and footage. They say, well, you know, that's a guy, he put some tarpaulin over a boat frame and he put a stick up and wrapped it something around it. You know, the old classic Nessie in the water at night, close quarters, that one. So one was in Reader's Digest, I think. So that's what happened there. And this one, that was a duck, but they blurred that photo. You know, that's like a cormorant or something like that. My most favorite piece of lake monster footage is the Lagerfjord worm from Iceland. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
No, I haven't.
And that animal in their history is called the Scrimsil. And it's supposed to be very big. So 20 foot 12, here we have this gigantic serpentine, bumpy, like crocodilian bumpy creature swimming through this frozen lake in Iceland, Lagerfjord. On top of the surface, and you can see its animate, you can see it's a creature, you can see this sort of the blowing of the bubbles, and some local farmer who lives near the lake is filming it. And then everybody says, well, you know what, he was just dragging a piece of rubbish in the water, that's kind of rubbish that he had, and you can see it doesn't move very far through the water. The assumption is basically it should be swinging by instead of perhaps looking for prey hanging about. You know, it is swimming slowly through the water, but it looks very large. Then there's a second piece of footage, which I think is more convincing, actually, where the creature is swimming under the water and undulating, and I actually twice avoid bumping into a little tiny ice floe, iceberg of some kind, and swims around. It seems to be incredibly long. Again, debunked, you know, this was just a guy had it on a line and he managed to avoid these icebergs. And that, to me, is the best piece of footage that we have. And yet, it's not convincing. So you have to focus on the witnesses themselves, because their cameras can lie or not depict what the eye can see clearly. But they themselves are normally, the impression it makes on them lasts for a lifetime.
Yes.
You know, with Bigfoot of lake monsters. And even people who have careers to risk sometimes go all out and say, "Then I won't deny it. I saw this thing." You know, it affects them so deeply. Because I think it's like, you know, when the Native American Indians saw the Columbus's ships coming in, they thought they were mountains. Right, their mind had to unmake your reality. You have to inculcate something new into your reality and say, now, I call that the temporary suspension of disbelief. So you have to temporarily suspend your preconceived belief and say, what am I seeing? Which is why, you know, in the old times, these creatures have the head of a camel and the paws of a fox and, you know, all these different features that you're trying to pick from animals you know to make up what you saw. And I think it's the same thing. It's better with the witnesses because they at least are convinced of what they saw enough to go on record.
And there's oftentimes an emotional component too, where they just, you can tell just hearing the tenor of their voice. If you're in their presence, you can see their body language, the immediacy as they relate the story to you, like they're reliving the experience. And another thing about the photography and the imagery is, it's never good enough for the skeptics, because even if you were to get 100% absolutely valid a video or a photograph, crystal clear imagery, someone's going to complain about it somewhere. And this whole horde of debunkers and naysayers will pop up. It acts like a lightning rod of criticism.
It is.
So from that standpoint, I can see why you're better off with the anecdotal witness testimony. Because, you know, you begin to develop this large corpus of information spanning the years from eyewitnesses, rather than however good the image or the video is, it can only tell so much of a story, and then the debunkers will have a field day with it anyway.
I think so. I think you're right. And in regards to, you know, what they see, you know, of course, the debunkers come into the frail brain theory then, or the what does Renee from Finding Bigfoot say? Bigfoot on the brain. They got Bigfoot on the brain because they were interested. So that's like a guy like me going out to find Nessie, finding Nessie, and somebody saying, well, you wanted to find it, so you must have imagined it. It's strange, isn't it?
Yes.
You go out looking for what you meant to look for, you found it, and yet your desire to look for it somehow excludes
the validity. Obviates it. It makes it a possibility. It's kind of
Surely you went out there looking for Nessie, and there you found it. It's a bit suspicious. So, for me personally, and there is talk of a TV show, by the way, or documentary. So I'm currently involved in a documentary called Cryptozoologist with Matt Ralston and Brad Abrams. You might know about that, and that's a Kickstarter project. Now they've got Lauren Coleman, Lyle Blackburn, Adam Davis, Linda Godfrey. Deborah Haswell, Richard Freeman's in it, I'm in it, and some others that haven't been announced yet. And that's a great project that people are really getting involved with. And they're looking there at the people themselves. They're not looking for the creatures. This is about the cryptozoologists, why they do what they do, and what made them this way. You know, why did they choose to be penniless pariahs? And surely there's something, you know, there's some reason.
And that's, it's a very good angle to come from, because, you know, at the end of the day, it becomes more, when depending on one's perspective, a human story, because it affects the recipients. It affects the people who had encounters or had been eyewitnesses to these events, to these creatures. And so, you know, a lot of times we project outward and let's study the phenomena. Let's really get into the mystery. But then again, it's like, you know, I mean, if a tree crashes in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a crashing sound? You know, it's one of those things. You know, that's a very good approach. Focus on the people who have made it their calling and have a deep emotional vested interest in it. Well, we've reached the end of a very fascinating first half with our special guest, Andy McGrath, and we're just getting started because Andy's got so many more stories about flying cryptids, and I really want to hear about the dogmen throughout the UK. This is the Cosmic Switchboard Show, and if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to our website, thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member. We will have all of Andy's bio information and information about the cryptozoology documentary he just described in our dedicated YouTube channel as well as on our website. So we've reached the end of the first segment, and we'll see you at the top of the next hour.